It's Friday, May 24th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, Amanda Churchill's first novel, The Turtle House, required some patience.
And there were times that I stopped and like, this is insane. I don't know what I'm doing. But I had readers and friends who were kind of keeping up with me and reading parts of it going, no, you really do have something here. This really will work.
She'll be at Pearl's Books next week, and we'll talk with her about her book today. Plus, finding the contemporary in a 55-year-old Neil Simon play.
I feel like she sounds like now, and the things, there's an independence about her that she's not sitting around waiting for life to happen to her. She is going after it. She's embodied and is going to make her life what she wants.
Last of the Red Hot Lovers on stage next month. First, the news from NPR.
Opera in the Ozarks presents its 73rd summer season, June 21st through July 19th, with 22 performances at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs, plus special events in Fayetteville and beyond, featuring 40 premier vocalists from across the nation. This year's operas include La Traviata, The Crucible, Beauty and the Beast, and L'Enfant à la Sortilège. Tickets and season schedule at opera.org.
A pleasant Friday to you. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later this hour, Amanda Churchill's first novel, The Turtle House, explores an intergenerational relationship in which a grandmother and granddaughter both have secrets. She'll read from the book next week at Pearl's Books in downtown Fayetteville. And we'll learn more about an overlooked Neil Simon script coming back to life next month with the Smokehouse Players. First up, Michael Tilley helps us review some of the news covered this week by Talk Business and Politics. He's with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back, but now I'm a little distracted. I didn't know anything that Neil Simon had ever written. It was undiscovered or unknown
well,
by this point.
Well, not undiscovered, but The Last of the Red Hot Lovers is not, you know, the odd
well known.
Couple.
Okay.
Yeah. So now you'll have to listen to the second half hour.
I plan on. Okay.
Okay. We had some new population figures from the U.S. Census Bureau this week. Fayetteville went over 100,000. Fort Smith was more or less flat in population. Not everyone thinks that's true.
Right. So, yes. Yeah, so the population of Fort Smith declined by 0.7% according to the census estimate. As we know, the census are hard numbers every 10 years, and they do estimates in between. But both City Director LaVon Morton and the mayor were not happy. And I talked to Mr. Morton. He was more than not happy. He was somewhat incensed. But they're basing it on you just drive around. Look at the number of houses that have been built. Look at all the jobs that we've had. There's no way the population figures can be down. Mayor McGill's take was that, well, maybe it's down a little bit, but that's because folks are moving in and out. You know, they're living on the periphery of Fort mm-hmm. Smith. And it'll eventually come up. And they both point to, this pilot training center that's coming to town. Other jobs, you know, Mars is just now it's kind of an expansion and finally came clean with how many folks they employ. But they don't have any specific evidence that it's wrong. And they don't argue that any of the other cities are wrong in terms of population. LaVon Morton is and I don't know how successful he can be with this, but he has talked about, you know, maybe pushing for a recount, so to speak, a re-estimate. I don't know how you recount an estimate, but, you know, he's pushing for that. And I don't blame him. As we know, a lot of federal dollars can be tied to population numbers, you know, from water and sewer systems, which are somewhat important in the city at this point, highway dollars, healthcare dollars. There's a lot of dollars tied to population counts.
You mentioned water. The Fort Smith Board of Directors wasn't it Monday when they talked with some citizens
public hearing.
We know that there is this big cliff coming up when it comes to paying for infrastructure corrections. Water rates are going to be part of it at some point?
Yeah, so they have to be. And this has been on the table now for several months. There's even state law behind it, which Fort Smith was able to kind of get amended in the last legislative session. I'm not going to go into the details, but the state of Arkansas essentially told cities, look, you have to look at what your water costs you to provide, and you've got to start charging people that you can't be getting behind mm-hmm. because your system will get behind. And, you know, we have this consent decree thing in Fort Smith that's cost us several hundred million dollars already, will cost us more, several hundred million more on the sewer system. And that's because for decades, many decades, the city of Fort Smith, for various reasons, would not increase the cost for the for what it costs for the residential bills for sewer system, residential, commercial, industrial. They either didn't have the political will or whatever. And so eventually, as we all know, you know, what it cost you 10 years ago to do something doesn't – it's going to cost you a lot more. So here we are, and it's – the question, I think, is have we learned our lesson from the consent decree? So there are some city directors who say, yes, we need to raise rates. There are a few city directors who are pushing back. They want to look at other things. But the rate structure initially is not a lot more. It's about $2 a month for kind of the average user. It'll go up now over the next several years. The initial rate plan would have it going up, you know, depending on how much you use, anywhere from $10, $20, maybe more a month. That's for some of the higher-end users. But Fort Smith really doesn't have a choice. We haven't raised rates, water rates, since 2011.
Wow.
Again, what do you know? Are you still paying 2011 for gas or
I try,
rent or insurance? But definitely not insurance.
No.
So the good thing is, let me cut to the chase, at this Monday public hearing, myself and Tina Dale, the reporter, were somewhat surprised, maybe even pleasantly so a little bit, at the number of citizens were there saying, yeah, you need to raise our rates. Yeah, and try to do it as little as possible.
Sure.
But yeah, we want to make sure that we're getting – that we have a good water system. We'll have a good water system in the future. And we don't have this come-to-Jesus meeting several decades in the future where the feds are saying, you've got to raise your rates to fix your water system or we're going to take it over. So – but the city board just can't make the move. So they're going to have a few more public hearings for I don't know what. But it's – I don't see this unless there's some change in the behind-the-scenes politic, and I don't see a vote in the near future. It might be another month or two.
Let's now catch up on some stories that we've been following, I think, every week. But every week there's a little bit something different, starting with the Fort Chaffee Redevelopment Authority. There are four entities that are part of it.
Yeah, four beneficiaries, Sebastian County and the cities of Fort Smith, Greenwood, and Barling.
Three of them had said, we're ready for you to dissolve.
Yes, Fort Smith, Greenwood, and Barling were like, yeah, you've done a great job, but it's time to pack it up and go home. And by the way, the Fort Chaffee Redevelopment Authority was created back in 1997 to manage all of this excess, a little over 7,000 acres, that the Army gave back to the communities from Fort Chaffee.
A necessity, really.
Yeah. And look, the FCRA over time has done a pretty good job of putting that land back to use. But there's only a few hundred acres left, and these local governments think, hey, it's time. And this organization was never set up to be permanent. But recently, the Sebastian County Quorum Court, in fact, this week, they piled on also, so to speak, and said, yeah, it's time to go. Now, the trust, again, is pushing back. They've even said, we'll wrap it up when we want to. Thank you very much. And the way the law is that created it, that only the FCRA board can uncreate it, undo it.
So you have the four entities who have said, yes, we think it's time to wrap up and close shop. FCRA says no. What does this mean for the four entities?
They just will have to find some ways to apply pressure, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they want to do. You know, the four entities, to some extent, to different extents, provide infrastructure support, water, sewer.
Mm-hmm.
So, at some point they want to play hardball, there's some ways to play hardball. I don't think it'll come to that.
Okay.
But, and believe it or not, as many years as I've spent in journalism and have become somewhat crusty and cynical on some things, I'm somewhat optimistic on this that cooler heads will prevail because the more I talk to folks, there just seems to be a growing consensus that And the right thing to do is to wrap it up sooner rather than later.
And it looks like there's some more money now headed towards this pilot training operation?
Yes. So there were already, you know, we've got fiscal 2024 funding, which is a little over $320 million, kind of the rough estimate that's come to this pilot training center at Ebbing Air National Guard Base in Fort Smith. And the early, so the, and there'll be more, but the early word on the fiscal 2025 year is we're already seeing $70 million in a House appropriations bill. It's just out of House appropriations, hasn't yet passed the House,
sure.
Hasn't passed the Senate, but that's an early sign that more money's coming and a substantive amount is coming on that.
All right, we'll keep track of all of this. You can keep track at talkbusiness.net. You and I will take a week off. We're doing archive shows next week.
Good. Okay.
So, all right, so let's get together in 2 weeks in June.
Well, that'll give me time to come up with something clever to say about you and your dog again, maybe.
Okay, all right. Michael Tilley, thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Last month, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on behalf of five plaintiffs against the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration. They are challenging a recent emergency rule that restricts the ability of transgender and non-binary Arkansans to self-identify their gender on driver's licenses. Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani spoke with ACLU Arkansas Legal Director John Williams and plaintiff Brandon Gallagher about the lawsuit and the current period for public comment against the charge.
What was the ACLU Arkansas's initial response to the state's announcement about the removal, and discuss your initial concerns and your subsequent decision to file the lawsuit?
Sure. You know, so as you know, this was announced back in March, really without any sort of notice to anybody. No one knew this was coming. We put out a statement on March 12th. I mean, I think we're concerned about two things, right? I think one is that we're concerned about the substance of this rule. You know, it does not respect the dignity of folks who do not meet, your standard binary genders, right? And we're, as an organization, we're very concerned about the rights of transgender, non-binary, and intersex Arkansans who are in the minority in our state, and who have, really been the target of legislation in the state recently. So as a matter of substance, we're concerned about the rule itself, and our statement reflects that. I think we're also concerned about the fact that this was done on an emergency basis without any real justification for that. And, you know, the law, the Arkansas Administrative Procedures Act, says that to pass a emergency rule that is without notice and comment, where someone would be able to go and explain why that rule might be a bad idea, that the state has to identify a imminent peril to public health safety or welfare. And we didn't see any sort of statement that the emergency rule satisfied that. We didn't see any sort of imminent danger to public health safety and welfare. You know, folks have been able to select their gender on their licenses or select an X for over a decade now, and there's nothing to suggest that the situation has changed that would create the imminent peril that the statute requires.
Brandon, how did you feel about taking that step to move forward with the ACLU and move forward legally against the change?
I was exhausted from just the overwhelm of what they have been targeting and putting us under the stress of worrying about, you know, am I going to have my health care? Am I going to be able to stay in the state? Am I going to be able to keep my job? All of these questions before this happened. And then when this did happen, I realized that if this doesn't stop right now, then come legislative session in 2025, I'm going to have no hope of being able to even stay in the state of Arkansas, because they've clearly stated in their public notice that the purpose of a driver's license is also used for law enforcement, for accessing financial resources, for voting access, for healthcare and health insurance access. And so that's telegraphing to me that those are the next things that they are trying to set me up to not be able to access by making this gender marker change, because being intersex, I can't have just testosterone or just estrogen. I can't have just a gynecology exam or exams that are typically for males. Like, I have to have a combination of many of these things, because that's just the body that God gave me. And so setting me up in that position, I realized it was now or never, and I don't have a choice but to fight this, or else, you know, I would have to leave a home that I've been in for five generations and leave a job that I really enjoy doing. And it's just all stuff that I don't want to do and I shouldn't have to do. Another of the allegations in this proposed rule says that the DFA has a responsibility to make our gender marker on our driver's license match our physical characteristics and also match our Homeland Security and passport documents. And that my X on my gender marker currently does match. I have gone to great lengths to ensure that my current driver's license is actually legal and up to date and in compliance with all of the laws as I have understood them my whole life. And that by eliminating the X gender marker, it will actually throw my driver's license out of congruence with Homeland Security and my passport documentation and cause a lot of administrative problems for anyone who tries to process my identification moving forward, because it doesn't match federally. And so what they are alleging that they have a responsibility to do and what they're actually doing are in exact opposition.
There are four other plaintiffs involved. Do you know who they are? Is that information public? Are there safety concerns about those individuals? Because, you know, it is such a small amount of people in the state who have the X option on their ID.
From my understanding, when we got together before the ACLU lawsuit was even filed, there were, and as you know, a number of us that got together at my church to talk about what was going to happen. And there were a lot of safety concerns expressed there. And of those people in that group, only two of us are plaintiffs. I've never met the other three, but I know that just widely, we have a lot of safety concerns just existing in Arkansas, not because of most of the people who are our neighbors. Like, most of my coworkers are kind to me. Most of my neighbors are kind to me. It's not an issue. We're humans and we treat each other like humans, but there's just a very small base that the politicians are trying to rile up, who seem to have nothing better to do with their time than to hassle people. And when they don't know like how to heal themselves, they're taking it out on those of us that they don't understand. And so those safety concerns preceded the lawsuit, but I think for those of us who have had to make ourselves public because of it, it is exacerbated, yes.
And just to build on that and to answer the specific aspect of your question about are the plaintiffs public? Yes, they are. You know, I think they've all stepped forward and realized that they wanted to stand up for their rights against this policy. And so they're named in the papers. But the plaintiffs represent a spectrum of people who are affected by this. You know, we've got people who want to have an X on their license because they're non-binary. We also have transgender people who want to switch their license from male to female, or vice versa, because they've transitioned genders. And I think that's something that's important to understand about this particular regulation. It affects two classes of people specifically. It affects non-binary people who don't fit either of the traditional binary genders, and those people would prefer and is most accurate to have an X on their driver's license. There are also people who do identify with a binary gender, but it's not the binary gender they were born with. And this law makes it harder for them to obtain the correct gender after they've transitioned, because it requires a proof of a surgical sex change. There are reasons someone might identify with the gender they were not born with but not get a surgical sex change, such as lack of ability to do so, other restrictions on the ability to do so, or they're just not there yet. It doesn't mean they don't identify as the gender they want to have on their driver's license.
Kind of moving forward from that, we're going to talk a bit about the public comment hearing. What can people do about what's going on? How can they participate?
This is really what should have happened in the first place when the, you know, rather than passing an emergency rule that immediately stripped our clients of the ability to get the proper gender marker on their licenses, they should have put out notice they were thinking of doing this and offered this opportunity to comment. So this public comment period is open now, and there's going to be a public hearing in Little Rock at the, it's the room B401 of the Joel Y. Ledbetter building. This is a public notice that they've issued, which is in Little Rock on 7th Street around the Capitol area, around DFNA, on June 7th at 2024 at 9 a.m. That's when the public hearing is going to be for the DFNA. But people can also submit written comment. And if they are, I mean, in any time the government passes or proposes a rule that affects you, it's worth writing in and stating your position. And you can do that by sending an email to public.comment@dfa.arkansas.gov.
And I would just add to that that the public notice alleges that there is no financial impact from this decision, which I know firsthand is absolutely false because my employer is already experiencing financial impact from this. It alleges that it's based on the best available scientific, technical, and economic evidence available. And there are plenty of doctors and research papers that will very credibly attest that that's not true. So I would encourage anyone making public comments to actually read what it attests and consider what experience or evidence they can bring to enlightening the people making this decision.
There is currently an ongoing period for public comment on the emergency rule. The public hearing will be held June 7th, 2024 at 9 a.m. in the basement conference room B401 of the Joel Y. Ledbetter building at 1816 West 7th Street in Little Rock, Arkansas. All interested parties may attend and present their views on the proposed rule or submit written comments to the Department of Finance and Administration via P.O. Box or email. For more information, you can visit dfa.arkansas.gov and acluarkansas.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Sophia Narani.
Walmart Amp presents Maggie Rogers on the Don't Forget Me Tour, Monday, June 3rd, at the Walmart Amp in Rogers with special guest, the Japanese House. Tickets and more information at amptickets.com. KUAF is supported by Biotech Pharmacal. As we approach Memorial Day, owners Dale and Hope Benedict want to thank all current United States service members and remember those who pay the ultimate sacrifice and honor their families who carry on their legacy. Biotech Pharmacal offers hypoallergenic vitamins and supplements, including the new essential multivitamin, available locally or online at biotechpharmacal.com.
Hello, folks. This is Dave Smith, host of Ozark Highlands Radio. We have a special show for you this week as we dedicate the entire hour to a performer who has spanned many genres of music, from old time and bluegrass to country and honky-tonk. The fine musicianship of Marty Stewart and his fabulous Superlatives, with interviews and lots of their great music, this week on Ozark Highlands Radio.
Ozark Highlands Radio, Saturday night at 6. Amanda Churchill's debut novel, The Turtle House, is the story of a grandmother and granddaughter getting to know each other and discovering things about each other few other people, if any, know. From a contemporary setting in small-town Texas to pre-war Japan, the story navigates the idea of what could have been and what can still be. Amanda Churchill will discuss and read from The Turtle House Thursday night at Pearl's Books, sharing the night with poet Caroline Earlywine from Little Rock. This week, I talked with Amanda Churchill about the novel and about the concept of a granddaughter asking her grandmother about her life.
I think there is a lot to be said about telling your story and not being ashamed of who you are. And then you can move on in your life or just become who you really need to be. And it's trite, but not enough people do it. You know, it really is something that we say all the time. But I mean, how many people do you know that have like secrets or things they need to confess or things they just need to be openly and honestly, and they haven't. And so they're kind of stuck.
You mentioned telling the story, the grandmother, and will you pronounce her name for me? I've got to
Minako.
Minako.
Mm-hmm.
She literally tells her story in this mm-hmm. story, doesn't she?
Yes. And I love that. I actually had a chance to interview my grandmother back in 2009. And my grandmother was a Japanese war bride, and we had a lot of questions about her life that she had never truly answered, was very reticent to talk about. And in 2009, she'd gone through a cancer diagnosis, and I was going through like a big kind of like upheaval. I left my full-time job. I was finishing up my master's in creative writing, and I was pregnant all at the same time. And so I went over and started asking her questions, and she actually started answering them. So we came to a new place in our relationship at that time period too.
So we should point out that even though you interviewed your grandmother and she came to the United States from Japan as a woman married to an American, and that's the case for the grandmother in the Turtle House, this is not memoir.
It's not a memoir. No, I used my grandmother's stories as kind of a jumping off point to create a fictional life for me, Nico. But there are big chunks of story that is true. But like with any kind of, I don't know, reporting or getting someone's life on the page, there were a lot of things I didn't ask and I didn't know. And so when I started writing out these stories, I realized that I had huge holes. And I didn't always know the motivation behind some of the things that occurred. And so that's when the glories of fiction came in, and research, lots and lots of research.
These are two characters who are slowly revealing themselves to each other and to us, the reader. And I wonder what that was like creating that, and how you knew how to pace the story.
The pacing was a challenge for me, because it was my first foray into something very long. I had always been terrified of writing a novel. I'd written so many short stories and so much flash fiction, and I understood the pace of like 10,000 words or less. So with this one, I actually created the historical part first and just went from chapter to chapter, telling and retelling and then recreating the stories of my grandmother, and then went back and wove in Leah's tale in between. And so I just wanted it to have like a nice pace to it. The chapters that are historical are like similar page lengths, word lengths, same with Leah's section. And I wanted to tie them together as the reader would end one section and go to the next. I wanted some kind of replication of like an image or a color or a word to kind of help guide them through that transition. Because I had read so many stories like this before that were a little bit jarring when you turn to that and saw the brand new chapter. And I didn't want that for my readers. So I hope I accomplished that for everybody.
Leah and her grandmother are both coming out of situations that they really weren't happy with. Leah with her career, her grandmother with, you know, a sort of life and marriage that wasn't fulfilling. How did you go about creating them and their sharing of their feelings?
You know, I really looked back to my own grandmother and my own interviews with her and how we came to talk about things that had really been traumatic. And a lot of it was, I would ask a question and she would kind of ignore me. My grandmother would turn up the television. We had actually had Japanese satellite television shot into her home, which back in 2009 was not really common. I'm sure my dad paid a ton of money to make this happen for her. And she would like crank up the sumo wrestling or her favorite soap opera at the time and would literally just ignore me for a few minutes. And so I would sit and watch the show with her, which does not have subtitles and I do not speak Japanese, and feel kind of awkward and weird. And then after a while, she'd get back to me and she would answer the question. And so I think a lot of this coming to terms with our stories or the stories within the book, it almost starts as like, tell me about this, and the person tells about something else. And I think that's how we tell the truth in real life too. Sometimes, like if you're talking to a kid, I'll ask my son, like, what happened to this? And he'll be like, remember that time? Or he'll tell me a story in a different way. And I think that's how people like to tell truths. They kind of wander a bit. And so I let my characters do that and then slowly guided them to where they needed to be.
For a first novel, writing one that, you know, is somewhat nonlinear because we go back to pre-war Tokyo and Japan, and then we're in Texas, but it's not necessarily present-day Texas. So you're doing that, and then you're also slowly revealing secrets. This doesn't sound like something that is the easiest first novel to write.
No, I have a tendency to bite off more than I can chew, and I did it with this. And I, as I was writing it, and I was like, if I can pull this off, this will be great. But if I can't pull this off, I will need to find a different thing to do with my life. I'll definitely need to go back to like flash fiction, 500 words or less, where I can control the situation. And there were times that I stopped. I'm like, this is insane. I don't know what I'm doing. But I had readers and friends who were kind of keeping up with me and reading parts of it going, no, you really do have something here. This really will work. And so through just patience and then a lot of revision after and making sure that everything was, all my T's were crossed, my I's were dotted and straightening the corners and ironing things out, it worked out. So
when I talk to someone who has written fiction, I don't like to, you know, give too much away from the book. But as you mentioned, there are secrets. There are things unknown. And how did you land on what those were for each of these characters?
Gosh. Well, with the grandmother character, some of those secrets were the secrets that my own grandmother carried with her. And then for Leah, you know, some of them were the secrets that I had happened to me as a young woman. And then also that had happened to my friend group kind of at the same time. And so when I was writing Leah, these memories kept coming back up because I had had two kids by that time. I was trying to make, you know, I was coming to grips with being older, an older woman with young children. I had turned the corner from just, you know, I wasn't even in my 30s anymore. I'd like really turned the corner. And I think just trying to think through my youth really made some of the stories kind of pop up and come to the surface. And so, yeah, I was really writing from a perspective of someone looking back and who had gone through the 90s and the early aughts and had graduated from a big Texas university and had gone into the career that she thought she wanted and was disappointed by what she found. So, yeah.
That does sound like Leah.
Yes. Well, you know, write what you know is what they say.
Right. Your MFA in creative writing, that was from North Texas and Denton?
Yes.
And I think I read that your thesis, your MFA thesis, was stories of Japanese internment camp families?
Yes. I was just fascinated. Once I think I saw a little snippet of a documentary, and I had heard about this and I knew about this. My grandmother actually had known someone who had been interred that she had met later in her life and told me about that. So it was like common knowledge within the family that this had happened. But something about seeing that documentary and knowing that people had had their entire lives changed and they had given up everything. And I think what grabbed me is kids left their toys and moms and dads left their photos, family photos behind, and they were never recovered. A lot of times everything was missing. They would give it to friends and family to take care of while they were in internment camp. And those things were sold or lost or thrown away. And it just, it hit me that how devastating could that be? So it was something I just became fascinated with. And I love to research and I am the geekiest person who loves to deep dive and find obscure books and pour through them and highlight them. So it was the perfect project.
We see Lee and her grandmother become closer as we move through the Turtle House. Did you feel you became closer to your grandmother when you were interviewing her about her life?
Yes, especially as I became older. I think she did open up to me because I had finally reached a point that she felt, okay, you know, I can, this one I can trust now. I mean, I would always been a trustworthy kid, but here I was coming back to her as a woman, pregnant and starting my own life. And she had gone through this experience that she realized that she wasn't going to live forever. And for a woman like my grandmother, who was so full of energy and really didn't think much about like growing old, I think it hit her hard. And so it was just, I mean, a perfect, horribly wonderful situation at the same time. But yeah, as a kid, she was definitely like, go play with your cousins, you know, get out of my hair, go do your thing. And I had finally grown up enough that I was no longer in her hair in the same way.
And of course, she's coming from, you know, a period, a situation that many of us can't imagine.
Right. And I don't think she ever really wanted to return to it in that way. And I know that answering the questions were hard for her because of the way she responded to them. She would take a breath and take a moment and take her time answering. And then finally come to it. I just had to be very patient and quiet and wait. And I'm good at that in that situation. So I guess my shyness has a way of being helpful sometimes.
You mentioned, you know, gaining her trust. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of parallel when you're writing a novel, thinking about gaining the trust of the reader, because you want them to go with you for the 250 pages.
Right. Definitely. I feel like the writer has to really believe in the story. I've written a few short stories before that I was on fire about, like page 1, 2, and 3. And then I started to fall out of love with the idea or even seeing some of the problems with it. And I couldn't make myself believe it. And therefore, how would I ever have a reader believe what I was writing? So whenever I start on a project, I have to fully 100% devote myself to it. Right now I'm working on another novel, and even though it's frustrating, and even though there are days that I'm like, okay, I think I erased more words than put them on the page, I have to ask myself, do I believe in the project? Do I believe what I'm saying? And if I say yes, then I just get up the next morning and try again.
I know from the conversation with you that your grandmother was Japanese. I'm going to guess from this conversation and listening to you talk, you're a native of Texas.
I am. Yes. Yeah. I actually live in my hometown. So a lot of people leave their hometowns. And I did. I tried really hard to get far away from it. I kept on saying I was going to move out of state. But it's like there's a force field or something around the state of Texas that does not allow me to leave. And so I'm still here in Keller, Texas.
You mentioned you couldn't get away from the force field for life, but you are getting away. You're going to be at Pearls on May 30th.
Yes. And I'm very excited because I love that part of Arkansas. I've been in residency there in Eureka Springs twice at Dairy Hollow, which is fabulous. My dad and mom used to take us camping up in that direction when we were kids. Just recently, my family and I went to camp. Once again, we're a big camping family out in Bentonville, and kids on bikes and stuff. So it's a beautiful area, and there's so many cool stores, and the people are so friendly. I'm just excited about being in Fayetteville.
Now, Amanda, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the first novel.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. It was great chatting with you.
Amanda Churchill's debut novel is The Turtle House. She'll be at Pearls Books Thursday night, along with poet Caroline Earlywine. I talked with Amanda Churchill via Zoom earlier this week. Yesterday on our show, I talked with Caroline Earlywine. If you'd like to hear that conversation, all about her collection of poetry, I Now Pronounce You, you can go to ozarksatlarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Becca Martin Brown, the Arts and Entertainment Editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Hi.
Hello.
It's so much more fun here in person.
I agree.
So I'm going to break one of my kind of rules.
Okay.
And tell you about a big deal first.
Okay, that's fine.
There's this band called the Rolling Stones.
Been around for a while.
There's this new arena up by Branson called Thunder Ridge Nature Arena. It was built by the guy who started Branson Pro Shop.
Bass Pro. Right.
Let's try that again. Who started Bass Pro Shop?
Right.
Johnny Morris.
Right.
It's brand new. It's opening for the first time this weekend. The Rolling Stones are playing there July 21st.
Wow.
Yeah, the Rolling Stones are going to be there and tickets go on sale May 31st. Now, there's this thing going on this weekend in Pocola, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Oklahoma Stole Competition.
Stole?
I assume you say it stole. S-T-O-L. It means short takeoff and landing.
Oh, like planes.
Yeah. You know, in the great books about Alaska, where somebody flies in to bring you supplies to your little homestead just south of the Arctic Circle,
mm-hmm.
that's a stole plane.
Okay.
It might be a plane that's set up to land on water, but it's still a stole plane because they can take off and land in little bitty spaces.
I understand. So this is a competition?
This is a competition, and it's happening at a new place in Pocola that is a fly-in community. And they're having this competition, and one of the people flying in it is a guy named Trevor Aldridge, who moved here when he got finished in the Air Force. He's flown with the Thunderbirds.
Okay.
He teaches flying at an Air Force base in Texas, and he does this stole thing, and he's like the star of this weekend show.
What's the competition?
I guess it's how tiny a place you can get in and out of. Today is practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to scoot on over there about now. And then tomorrow, the competition starts at 10 a.m. It's $20 to get in. Kids 15 and younger are free. It'll be interesting. It's at a place called Patriot Air Park.
Okay.
Let's talk about what they're doing at Arkansas Public Theater next.
They're doing a big musical is what they're doing.
And we have to talk about it today because we're not going to be here next week.
Right. We're taking a week
and
off from new shows.
And it opens next Friday. 28 years I've been waiting for this. 28 years Arkansas Public Theater is doing Rent.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. I mean, there's a generation. There's old people like me that love it too. Mm. But there's a whole generation, particularly of theater kids, that was influenced by this play.
Sure.
If you don't know the story, it's about a group of young folks, 20-ish,
mm-hmm.
living in New York City in places like abandoned warehouses. A lot of them have AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are navigating how to deal with that and how to deal with what at that time was pretty much a death sentence.
Right.
It's got music you've heard, like 525,000, 600 minutes, mm-hmm. Seasons of Love. It's got amazing actors.
Two weekends.
That's the new thing with the renovation of the theater
okay.
is two weekends. So it opens next Friday. It's going to be stunning. Now, Fort Smith Little Theater is doing a Mossart comedy called Light Up the Sky. They call it a tribute to the theater. There's a new play opening. Everybody has gathered at a hotel room. There's all of the quirky theater people that you know.
Mm-hmm.
The reviews come out, and then it gets wacky. And it opens Thursday night and runs for 2 weeks.
Okay.
So those are the things happening that I hope you will do.
All right. And you can read about this and much more in What's Up.
Sunday in What's Up, the cover is Rent. Great photo, which I didn't take, so I could say that. Do we have time to tell them my news?
That I've said you can tell people the news whenever you want.
Okay.
I'll leave that up to you.
So here's the news, guys. I'm retiring from the newspaper.
From the newspaper.
In July. Not because I don't love it anymore, but because I got things I want to do.
Right.
One of those things is doing a new segment with Kyle. So you're not getting rid of me yet. It will not be about spelling or grammar. I promise.
We've got that covered. Don't worry. All right. More about that as we get closer to the summer.
Yes. But, you know, send food, send sympathy cards, send whatever. It's been a really great run that started at the Springdale News.
All right. It's not over yet.
It's
not over yet. Until that day in July, Becca Martin Brown is the Arts and Entertainment Editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Thank you, Becca.
Thanks.
Can I ask you one question about your workout videos? Please do.
Doesn't wearing all that leather make you overheat?
Well, it's just the pants. I mean, if I got to run to the gym, whatever I got on is what I have on. I get it done.
Lenny Kravitz, the music, those workouts, and his new album, Blue Electric Light, plus the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. Can you feel my heart
racing? Weekend Edition, tomorrow morning, beginning at 7. Last fall, the Smokehouse Players production of Other Desert Cities raised more than $15,000 for Magdalene Serenity House, a nonprofit in Fayetteville dedicated to helping women who have experienced trauma, sexual exploitation, addiction, and incarceration. Nearly a dozen Smokehouse Player productions over the past few years have directed opening night proceeds to the nonprofit. Joy Beth Morris is development director with the organization, and she says the money generated by those opening nights has been a godsend.
It means the world to our board and staff, but most importantly, our residents. And this partnership developed at a time that was so crucial for our organization. We were brand new, and we didn't have staff and resources to put on our own event, but we desperately needed funding and awareness created in the community. And so this has just been a blessing that has really meant the world to us.
The Smokehouse Players are following the same plan early next month when they present Neil Simon's Last of the Red Hot Lovers at the old Ozark Mountain Smokehouse in Fayetteville at the corner of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Ruppel Road. The comedy opened on Broadway in late 1969, and it follows Barney, a middle-aged married man who thinks he's ready for an affair. Each of the three acts is an attempted tryst. The premise, set in 1969, could, one would think, be dated. This production remains firmly rooted 55 years in the past, but director Warren Rosenhauer says Neil Simon's script is surprisingly contemporary for 2024 audiences.
The language and the dialogue and the situations are now. I mean, these people could be here now dressed in modern clothes. Some of the colloquialisms that they use or proppy things they use are a little dated, but beyond that, his dialogue is spot on the way people talk today. So you could do it now, you could done it in the 90s. That it's that kind of show.
Tim Gilster, one of the founders of the Smokehouse Players, is Barney. He says his character is living an okay life and is experiencing what future generations would label FOMO, the fear of missing out.
All three of these women he attempts to have an affair with, it all becomes a hilarious disaster. But he's somebody who always feels like his life wasn't terrific, it was simply nice.
He says while Last of the Red Hot Lovers isn't as well known as Simon's works like The Odd Couple or Barefoot in the Park,
but it's a very strong play, and I'm a Neil Simon fan. I really am. When I was in high school, I would go into the library and look up Theater World and see Art Carney and Walter Matthau and all those pictures and stuff. And it's a lesser known, but it's still a very strong Neil Simon.
While Barney is a presence throughout the play, he's in every single second of each of the three acts. Each of those three acts' other character is a different woman. Barney's first would-be partner is Elaine, played next month by Amy Jones.
There are intimations that her home life might not be, you know, the best. I feel like she's lonely, and I feel like she is an artist. She's got a very sensual take on the world. She inhabits the world through her senses, and she wants to make the most of it.
Jones says despite Elaine being a character written more than a half century ago, she feels very modern.
I feel like she sounds like now, and the things, there's an independence about her that she's not sitting around waiting for life to happen to her. She is going after it. She's embodied and is going to make her life what she wants. She's going to go after what she wants.
The second act focuses on Bobby Michelle, played in the Smokehouse Players production by Juliette Robinson. She's the youngest of the three women in the play, and Robinson says this woman does share some characteristics with another role Robinson had in a previous Smokehouse production when she was Honey in Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Similar in a sense that they both had dreams. They felt a bit restrained by their world. However, watching Bobby cope with the reality of her life, it's really interesting. And that is the same with Honey and Virginia Woolf. But they both come about it in different ways. And so similar themes, I would say. But I love Bobby, and I really hope the audience does too. She's very funny.
And the third act features Jeanette, as played by Terry Vaughn. Vaughn is another co-founder of the theater company. Vaughn says while Barney's first two would-be liaisons were with strangers, Jeanette represents a different encounter entirely.
She's friends with his wife. Her husband is Barney's best friend. So this encounter for Jeanette is extremely dangerous because she's going into this apartment with him and she's so terrified that she's going to get caught. And then you add that to the fact that she's probably the most depressed woman that ever lived, depressed by humanity and very depressed by the sexual revolution and the fact that it's created a world that she can't fit in anymore. And she's agreed to come, but Jeanette's not looking for sex. Jeanette's looking for companionship and someone to commiserate with.
As is common with Neil Simon play and movies, the dialogue spins and sways in a certain rhythm. That requires timing and actor's trust. Director Warren Rosenhauer says that can be challenging, as can this production setting. The play will be presented in the round.
A different challenge than your regular proscenium type stage where your audience is sitting facing. And two, there are only two people on stage at one time. So you have to listen to the rhythm of the characters' speeches and how they're speaking to make kind of meaningful movements instead of just having them static in one place talking the whole time. I mean, it is quite some challenge to have some meaning to, okay, do I stand up here? When do I do? When do I get this? And to keep the two people not constantly moving, but movement that's interesting so the audience doesn't think, oh, they're just standing or sitting saying their line.
The Last of the Red Hot Lovers will open Thursday night, June 6th, at the Old Ozark Mountain Smokehouse at 1725 South Smokehouse Trail in Fayetteville, and it will run for 3 nights, ending on Saturday night, June 8th. Doors each night at 6:30, curtain up at 7:30. Tickets are free, and the audience is seated on a first-come, first-served basis, no reservations. And the Thursday night show, again, is the benefit performance for Magdalene Serenity House. 100% of what is collected at the door will go toward that nonprofit. And there are several donors who will match what is given at the door. You can find out more about the Smokehouse Players and this production of Last of the Red Hot Lovers on Facebook. Oh, and by the way, the Smokehouse Players have selected another American stage classic for their next performance in October, the decidedly not comic Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. This is Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF and 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors this Friday included Sophia Narani, Michael Tilley, and Becca Martin Brown. Our theme is titled The First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl's most recent CD of solo guitar music is titled Still Here. Our director of community engagement at KUAF is Jasper Logan. Our technical director is YK Karenbauer. Our membership director at KUAF is Lisa Alt. You can listen to past editions of our show and find past individual stories and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. If you heard something today that you want to hear again or you want to share with someone you know through email or social media, we make that easy to do at Ozarks at Large as well. Just ozarksatlarge.com, I should say. Just go to that site, look for the story or interview you're looking for. There's a link there that will let you share with whomever you'd like. Matthew Moore will be with listeners in Northwest Arkansas Sunday morning for Weekend Ozarks at Large at 9. Next week, archive shows as we take a break. Don't forget Tuesday, a very special show, however, on Ozarks at Large as we have the spring performance from the Fort Smith Chorale. Continue that tradition on Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Carver Center for Public Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art presents The Portal, an immersive art experience by renowned singer Jewel. It features one-of-a-kind 200-piece aerial drone shows, a meditative art walk, chef-crafted dining options, and more. Open now. Tickets at crystalbridges.org.